I thought you were recording.
I'm recording now. So some of you know who I'm talking to because you've already subscribed to her channel. Karen is an artist who lives in the Bay Area, and we had a conversation 2-3 weeks ago.
I think so.
Okay. And I thought that went very well. I think it was very well received on the channel, and she has her own channel. And talking with Travis, actually signed up and he had to cancel. So you got to go on your channel first.
We had so much fun talking.
I listened to some of it. I haven't listened to the whole thing, and it sounded like a fun conversation.
Yeah, it was unbelievable how many connections we had. Just unbelievable.
So I'm looking forward to talking to him. But as I was just telling you, I'm getting so many requests for conversations, both from people who watch my channel and now increasingly other people, like other YouTubers or scholars or, and I really want to follow up on some of those conversations too. So I have to figure out how to manage, this and not hurt my church in the process. You know, I want this to be an overall blessing for my church, not hurt it. And summer's a weird time because my kids are home and my wife isn't teaching school. And so it's just busier, ironically, when they're all off doing their own thing. I have a little bit more free time. So it's just busy. So, well, so you say you're having fun with your channel.
I am having a great deal of fun. And, if anybody who's watching this decides to help me name my channel, I would be all in on that. I have a few ideas, but I'd like to give it a name so that if people are searching on YouTube for something, they'll just stumble onto my channel. Because if I just leave it at Karen Wong, there are probably 50 Karen Wongs, and there's nothing to differentiate me from anybody else. So.
Yeah. Wong's a pretty common name out here in California.
Sure is.
Vanderclay, not so much. So
yeah,
helps me. So what were you thinking about talking about today?
Well, so last time I was talking to you, afterwards I told you I kind of wish that we had touched on this idea of love and suffering. And so I've been giving that a lot of thought, and that has kind of given some structure to the threads that I've been following, kind of trying to untangle some things in my own life and figure out how I think somebody noticed the other day that I talked about how I talk from the basement. I structure the basement first before I come out with an idea. And so I kind of think every person has a basement that is what they're composed of, how they got to be where they are. And so I was trying to figure out, why do I feel the way I feel about love and suffering? And so I started untangling some of the threads of my life and just trying to put it together, thinking, okay, I'm going to tell Paul my story.
Okay.
I thought, wow, I've had such a rich life. It's just unbelievable, you know?
Good.
Just unbelievable.
Good.
It intertwines with the history of evangelicalism since 1980. It intertwines with the political landscape since 1980. It intertwines with just, you know, the musical scene, everything that I became a Christian in 1980. And so for me, that's kind of when everything started. So,
Well, go ahead and jump right in. Usually okay. The first conversation we do the story stuff, and the second conversation we get into whatever. We reversed it with you. We had that video, I think, was very, people really liked it. You really put things together well for people, and that was very well received.
Well, I think people like to, what they tell me is people like to have the bottom line first.
Okay.
Because they don't want to listen to the basement unless they have the bottom line. So.
Okay.
So let me give you the bottom line first.
Okay.
The bottom line is that there's something about the individual that is very important in the way the universe is structured. And I think I'm going to say two things about that right now. And that one is that God works with each individual in a very unique and individual way. And also that suffering is a very individual thing. I think we talk a lot about, oh, the suffering of this people group or the suffering of that that family. We tend to talk in group when we talk about other people's suffering. But everybody who has ever suffered knows that your suffering is unique and no one else can begin to understand what you're going through. They might say they do, but the only one who can really understand what's happening inside of you is Jesus. So so I those are two things that I've learned. And I remember in 1988, when I was a missionary in Japan, and I was a fairly new believer. I'd only been a believer for about 7 years, so I didn't know much. And here I am trying to be a missionary.
In Japan. Hard place.
And I was reading the Bible, and I stumbled on Philippians 3:10. For I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection. And I thought, yes, that's what I want. And then I read the second half of the verse. And the fellowship of sharing in his sufferings. And I didn't really know what that meant, but it scared me because 2 years previous to that, when I had first arrived in Japan, I got a notice that my brother had died in a small plane crash in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And because of our financial situation as missionaries, I wasn't able to go back for the funeral. So that was a long period of suffering. Just trying to suffer with my parents who were back in the United States and trying to sort out things that had been left unsaid with my brother and arguments that we'd had about the existence of God and all of these things that you have no answers for any of it. But the conclusion that I came to after 6 months of suffering through that was that the only thing that I could hold on to for sure is that God is good. And that sort of became my lens. So here I am 2 years later after my brother's death, and I run across this verse and I think, well, yes, I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection, but I don't want to go through suffering like that again. I'm scared. But I didn't know what was coming. I didn't know what was going to come after that, which is probably a very good thing because I would have bailed out.
Yeah.
But I want to go back a little bit and explain how I got to be a missionary in Japan.
Okay.
So in the late 70s, I got very interested in the turmoil that was going on in the United States, the political restlessness, the economy was a disaster in shambles. There was a lot of talk about, in fact, we were saving tuna fish and toilet paper in our closet because we were convinced that the economy was going to come apart at the seams and we were going to be on our own. So we bought a little farm out in the country that we could grow our own food on, and we were going to make our way through this tragedy that way. And so I started reading all kinds of, we were in a way, we were hippies turned preppers. So then I got interested in politics and economics, thinking I could make a difference. But then one day I finally realized, wait, this is way bigger than I am. It didn't matter how many letters I wrote to the editor or, you know, how many envelopes I stuffed for politicians. This problem was way bigger than I am. And it was that realization that led me one thing after another until I stumbled into a church. That's a whole nother long story. But in that church, I ran across a little book that was called Secular Humanism in the Light of the Holy Scriptures by Homer Duncan of Lubbock, Texas. I always think of him with great fondness. Because one of the things I had been concerned about was an organization that was promoting humanism in the public schools. And in their literature, they were saying things like, we want to control the minds of the children of America. And I'm thinking, okay, I've got a 9-year-old daughter. I don't want her mind being controlled by anybody, but I don't know anything about humanism. I have no idea what it is. But here was this book promising to tell me. And it was going to tell me something about humanism compared to the Holy Scriptures. And I knew nothing whatever about the Bible. I had no background.
This is the late 70s.
Yeah, this is 1980 now. Okay. This is 1980. Okay. So I pick up this book and I read it, and it made so much sense to me. And I knew I didn't want humanism. So I thought, I must want this other thing. And that led me on a search for trying to understand what there was in Christianity. And within a few months, I was at an old-fashioned tent revival in Iowa. And I walked down the sawdust trail and kneeled at the altar. And I didn't really understand what I was doing, but I knew it was something I wanted. And I'm not sure how effective the transaction was at that moment, but it got me on a path and got me involved in a little country church that taught the gospel in an area where there were five small towns around where that church was. And I don't think there were any other gospel teaching churches in those towns.
Now, when you say it taught the gospel, a lot of people, well, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, okay. So that I should quit using Christian lingo, right?
Yeah, should.
It was a church where it had been a friend's church.
Okay.
And there's a lot of one of the things I hear on your channel is a lot of people talking about all these different denominational threads and Eastern Orthodox versus evangelicalism versus Catholicism and all that. And part of what I want to say is that I've had an experience with almost every denomination there is, and I've either been to their churches or I've had friends in those churches, or I've, in one way or another, through all these pathways, I've been involved. And there are believers who love the Lord Jesus Christ and are totally dedicated to him inside every one of them. So many of these denominational differences are peripheral to true meaning. I think we get involved in a lot of debates and discussions and arguments that are fun, they're interesting, but they're peripheral. So this little church had been a friend's church, and the friend's church idea was in the way back, you sit and you wait for God to speak. And by the time I got to this church, the pastor who had been there before had moved on, and they had gotten a pastor who was a guy and his wife who had been missionaries to the Navajo Indians in Arizona. And he was from Kansas, and so he was not a friend's pastor, but he was a absolutely remarkable human being, he and his wife both. And whenever we had a question about the Bible, he would jump in his car and drive the 10 miles to our farm and just lay it out for us and help make sure we got all our questions answered. Always focused on Jesus Christ as the way, the truth, and the life. And so many things happened all at that same time. So I had just become a believer. Outside of our small town, there was a nightclub, and the owner of that nightclub came to Christ and decided to turn his nightclub into a Christian dinner theater. And so he started inviting Full Gospel Businessmen's Association guys in there to talk and have these dinner meetings. And Full Gospel Businessmen isn't just men. There would be men and women. But so that was more of the charismatic side of things. And so I heard a lot of messages from those folks. And then in the middle of that, within just a few months after I became a believer, I was asked if I would run for the state legislature in Iowa. And so I got involved in this campaign, and I'm going door to door in all these small towns and just meeting all kinds of people of every stripe and building deep friendships with some of them. And I got elected, and I served for 2 years and became very, very controversial. I don't know if the newspaper articles are still available, but I was very controversial.
What did you do to become controversial, may I ask?
Well, there were several things. Part of it was that I joined up with the conservative element in the legislature, and there were There were 12 guys that were conservatives, and so they called those guys the Dirty Dozen. And when I got elected, I was the only woman that was considered a conservative. And so, you know, then they called me the Baker's Dozen or something like that. But there were a few issues that came up that were appalling is probably the best word I can use for it. The one I became most controversial about was a sex ed curriculum that had been developed by the Iowa State University Home Ec Department. And it was to be used to teach sex ed. They called it parenting education, but basically it was a sex ed curriculum for the high schools. And I have no problem whatever with sex education, but the direction of this was so appalling that in order to train the teachers, some parents came to me and told me that they were also teachers and had been in one of the teacher training classes. And in the teacher training class, they'd put the teachers in a darkened room and they would flash profanities. Well, worse than profanities, you know, the worst words you can think of. They would flash them on the screen in bright colors. And then they would tell the teachers, if there's any of these words that you can't say out loud, you need to get accustomed to talking about them without being embarrassed. You need to be desensitized. So go in your closet at home and say them as loudly as you can so that you get over the fear. And the reason they needed to be able to do that was that they would be, one of the lessons in the curriculum was to have the young people, this would be like for freshmen in high school, pair up with boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl. And they're supposed to talk to each other about all the dirty words that they hear on the playground relating to sexual activity. And then write the dirty word on a piece of paper and put it in a little jar. And the teacher would pull them out one at a time. And then she would say the word, the street word for it. And then she would give them the biological word for it. So every so I'm serious. I had no intention of talking about this, but you made me talk about this. So, you know,
this is a class curriculum.
Yeah. Every position you can think of. Okay. Every sexual position you can think of. There's a street word for it, but there's also a formal word for it, you know.
But they, you know, the kids don't learn this stuff on their own. I mean,
well, that's what I'm wondering. Okay, but beyond that, I thought the bigger issue for me, the issue wasn't was, oh, these are dirty words and people shouldn't be using them and they shouldn't be talking. That wasn't the issue. The issue was, why are we desensitizing people about something that is should be considered so beautiful and so purposeful and that has meaning? Why are we desensitizing people? So I paired up with a couple of other legislators who felt the same way I did. And this is so funny. We copied off some pages of this curriculum and put it into brown manila envelopes, sealed the envelopes and labeled them for each legislator. And then we had them distributed to the legislators so that they could get them at their desks. And the intern pages were the ones that were delivering this material.
Yeah.
So the first thing that happens is this other legislator gets his packet. He opens it up. He gets enraged and he stands up and you pull your mic up out of your desk. And so he stands up and pulls up his mic up to his mouth. And he says, this is absolutely disgusting that you would send material like this with the pages.
This is the school curriculum.
So I said, yeah, this is exactly why we want to inform everybody about it. And he said, teachers know what they're doing. And these people who have developed this curriculum know what they're doing. And you have no right to interfere in this because the educational system is doing the right thing for people. You should stay out of it. Well,
that's the same person that was offended because the page brought the envelope.
Well, you know what they say, cognitive dissonance.
That's hilarious.
So the next thing that we found out about was that they were using a video called the Quickie which was a speeded up version of a couple meeting at a motel room, taking off all their clothes, rolling around on the floor, having a sexual activity, and then putting their clothes back on and getting out and leaving the motel. And this was part of the desensitization program. So we had a private meeting with the legislators in a private room and showed this film to them. And we said, we do not think that state money should be used on something like this to desensitize people, because that's a problem. And man, we just got nailed from every side. So everybody was angry with us, and they decided to have a public meeting about this. So we have this big public meeting in Des Moines, and they invite people to testify from every different group. And of course, the NEA came to testify, the National Education Association. And then also the PTA came to testify. The PTA, they were all over our case. Keep your nose out of the schools. You don't know what you're talking about. The people who've developed this curriculum have a good purpose for it, and, you know, on and on. So anyway, my name got out in the news, and they were writing articles about me, and they didn't like me to start with because I was already part of the Dirty Dozen. And so, you know, they take the most unflattering photographs they can find, and and they dig up whatever they can about your past, and, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, all that to say that that was a part of my learning as a new believer, how to really trust God in the middle of a real pressure cooker. So I really went through it for a couple of years. And my daughter at the time was 11. So I was having to drive to the state house, like 100 miles from home, every Monday, and then come back on Friday afternoons. And my husband he was a teacher, but so he'd take her to school with him in the morning, and then he'd bring her home at night. So she was never alone without somebody, but certainly she was without me. And when she was in fifth grade, which would have been the second year I was there, the NEA decided after this earlier debacle that they wanted to get rid of me. So they sent out a bunch of material to everybody saying that I was trying to close the local schools. And so the teachers were having all their students write letters to me in protest about trying to close the local schools, which had nothing whatever to do with anything I was doing. And my own daughter was one of the students that this teacher was forcing to write a letter of accusation to me.
Just give it to Mom when she comes home.
Oh, no. They brought the class to the state house, and they delivered these letters to me personally. Yeah, so it was quite an experience. But through that, I also met people from every denomination, and I discovered something very interesting about politics, and that is, so at the end of this two-year period, when it was time to run again, I really made my own party very angry with me because I wouldn't bend the knee to a particular bill that they wanted to pass that they thought would look good on the election brochures. And I made the terminal error of exposing what they were doing by getting up and talking about it in the House chambers. But it happened to be at a time when the TV cameras were there for some other reason. So it got on the evening news, and the party looked at that and they said, we are going to take her out. So they ran somebody against me in the primary so that I couldn't. And the person who they ran against me in the primary had that seat before. So he had good name recognition. They knew he couldn't win the general, but he had good name recognition. So they ran him against me in the primary. He won the primary. He went on to lose the general election. And that was the end of my political career. But what I took away from that was that it doesn't really matter what party you belong to. The party in power wants to stay in power, and the party out of power wants to get into power. And they don't look at a bill in terms of what are the consequences going to be 5 years from now or 10 years from now, what snakes are buried in there. They look at it in terms of, does this look good on our reelection brochures?
Yeah.
And So I realized that political activity was not the solution. You can't impose. I mean, for example, everybody knows robbery is wrong, so we have laws against robbery, but that doesn't stop anybody from robbing your local 7-Eleven, right? So I felt like the Lord was saying to me, I change one heart at a time. It's the individual level. And that was what eventually led us to getting ready to go as missionaries to Asia. So in order to do that, I had to get a graduate degree in linguistics and teaching English as a second language. So that took me through another 2 years of very interesting time of working with doctoral students. And I think that's one of the things that led me to this whole thing that I have about trying to find underlying principles, because learning ESL taught me how to communicate with people of other languages, but at a very, at the simplest conceptual level possible to still get the information across. So I had many students who were working on their doctorates and they're trying to write their doctoral dissertation, but their English is very limited. So how could I help them take their ideas and put them into a kind of English that would be useful for their, you know, for their future career and their dissertation and so forth?
So that's also English as a second language in Japan, as that was part of your missionary work.
Yes. Yeah. That's how we met people. That was our whole way in to meet people. But before I leave Iowa State University, I have to tell you about this one Chinese guy that I met who was working on his doctorate in quantum physics. So I don't know if you remember when Evangelism Explosion was big. So I was going to an E-free church at the time and got involved with the Evangelism Explosion training. And I was out working with my partner, and we contacted one of my students who had shown some interest in a previous conversation that I had had with him. So I said, hey, could we come and have a cup of coffee with you and talk with you about this more? And he said, sure. So we were talking to him, and we started to share the story about Jesus Christ being the way, the truth, and the life, to put it simply. Yeah. And that Jesus Christ was the Logos. And we're, you know, sharing with him the basic kind of stuff that we did with the Evangelism Explosion. And he said, well, you know, I'm so glad you're talking to me about things like this, because he said, last night I laid awake all night long thinking about something. And he said, I don't have the answer to it, but maybe what you're telling me, maybe there's some answer. And I said, well, what were you thinking about? And he said, well, you know, black holes absorb light. They absorb light endlessly. And he said, and still there's light in the universe. Mm-hmm. Said, you know, I can't find the answer to that. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, that's beyond, you know, that's above my pay grade. So I had nothing for him. But we left him with one of these little books of John. A little booklet, and I said, on Thursday we'll come back and we'll bring you a whole Bible, because I didn't have a whole Bible with me. So we went back on Thursday, and he comes to his dorm door and he said, I found it. He found what? He said, I found the source of the light. No, because it says in the book of John that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then down in verse 14, I think it is. And
the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness does not overcome it.
Yes, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Yeah. Has not overcome it. And so I really started thinking about stuff, you know. And then later he told me another thought that he had, and I'm probably going to mess this up, but he said, you know, if you take if you live a life of 80 years, but without God, he said it's equivalent to zero. But if you live even 1 year with God, it's like infinite. And I said, can you show me? And he said, sure. And so it's, let's see, if you put God on the bottom, if you put infinity on the bottom, so it's 80 divided by infinity, that's nothing. It's meaningless, right? But if you put infinity on the top, infinity divided by one, so even one day, you're still infinity.
His little math trick.
So that's the way physicists think, right? When they come to the Lord. So, yeah. So anyway, so then we became missionaries. We went to Japan. And after we were in Japan 3 months, I find out about my brother dying in this plane crash. I struggle my way through that. And then I had my episode with Philippians 3:10 and afraid to think about the fellowship of his sufferings, you know, thinking about Jesus. And towards the end of 1988, my husband confesses to me one night that he is in love with another man and he is gay and he's leaving. So all of a sudden my world.
When had you married him, before or after he became a Christian?
Way before. Okay. We had been married 19 years.
He became a Christian same time you had?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So we both came to the Lord in 1980. And later when he told me, I did have a chance to talk with him at much more length later on, but he told me that once he made that decision to follow Christ, he was just crushed day by day by day, just increasingly crushed by the temptations and by, you know, just everything that went along with, yeah. Well, so I don't want to really go down that trail too much, but.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, there's a whole big long story there that I know you're cutting down on your conversation. So if we ever have another one in the future, we could explore that more. So I had no money because I couldn't take the donated money anymore that was supporting us as missionaries, and I had to figure out what was going to happen with life. I'd lost the love of my life, when I came back to the United States, I discovered that my mother had just come out of surgery for cancer and that the cancer was inoperable.
Oh my.
And that she had maybe 6 months to live. And something happened to my father when he got that news. And so his heart began to be irregular. And over the next 6 months while my mother was dying, my father's organs started to give out one after another. So during that time, I got a job working for the university, so there was this kind of triangle. There was the university was in Ames, my mother was in Carroll, which was 100 miles to the west, and my father was, or 50 miles to the west, 60 miles to the west, and my father was in Des Moines, which was 50 miles to the south of Ames, and so I was running this triangle many times every week, just to try to make sure I was staying in contact with everybody and taking care of everything, but still earning a living. And the thing that I learned through that, well, okay. So during that time, one thing I forgot to mention, well, there's so many things I forgot to mention. Anyway, I've been involved in many different types of churches. When we had been in the university before, we had gotten involved in a church that very quickly became apparent to us was a cult. And so after we got out of that church, we started having meetings at our house for people who were suffering as a result of what the cult had done to them. And that is a whole story in itself. I think they're still operating, but they may have made some changes in their theories about how the world works. Because when we finally discovered that they were a cult, it was primarily because the, I know this is a diversion. I'm probably diverting because I saw the look on your face when we hit the Valley of Suffering. So I diverted back to this previous history thing, which is kind of a thing that I learned to do, I think, because some people, kind of like in movies when they have the comic relief, you know, right in the middle of a movie. So probably shouldn't have done that. But since I started on it, I'm going to follow up anyway.
Okay.
So it was called Ames Fellowship Church at the time. And this is 1983. Okay. 1983. We're at the university working on our master's degrees. And it was the greatest church you ever saw. I mean, they were having this great revival on campus. They were having big meetings on campus and students were coming and they had all their own music that they had written to verses in the Bible. And the music was great and we were loving it. And we were, you know, the Bible teaching was very expository, just excellent all the way around. And then we realized that something was missing. And what was missing was the Holy Spirit. It was the Father, the Son, the Holy Scriptures. And then the elders took the place of the Spirit because they told everybody what to do. The elders would tell all these single people who they should date, tell them where they should live. And they came up with this mantra, every man should want to live up to the expectations of the qualifications for being an elder. And every woman should want to live up to the qualifications of being an elder's wife. So then that was their paradigm. If you couldn't live up to that paradigm, then you would get disfellowshipped. So there were a lot of hurting people coming out of that body. And that experience gave me a certain radar for being able to see when things are getting off kilter a little bit towards the legalism side of things. I think that one of the reasons I'm talking about all these different churches and experiences that bottom line, Jesus is faithful. So when you're one of his sheep, he keeps the pasture weeded for you. I know it's possible to stumble into something like that and get trapped in it, but I also know that there's some way that you can stay clear of that stuff. And I don't really, I realize now that what I just said a minute ago is only true on one level. And that is, it was true for me. That even though I didn't know anything about the internecine wars of all the different denominations, and I didn't know all the rules and regulations of all the denominations, and I didn't understand purity of doctrine or anything else, somehow Jesus has kept me safe through this whole long journey that I've had going through all these different denominations. Oh, I know. It's because of the suffering. I think suffering teaches us something at a deeply fundamental level that connects us to God, that keeps us safe from falling into the, you ever been to Yellowstone Park? You know, the paint pots that are on either side of the walkway? You don't want to fall into the paint pots, right? You want to stay on the trail. So I think suffering might be the connection that keeps us on that trail. So connected to that, I want to go back just a little bit to when my mom, I guess I haven't got there yet. When my mom was in the hospital at the very end of her life, she made it 5 months after that surgery, not 6 months. But I was in the hospital with her during the last day, and it was a Sunday. And I could, she was had been in a lot of pain, and she had actually gone into a coma like 3 days before. Well, a coma, I don't know. She was not there anymore. Because, and she had one of these pain machines where you can touch it and it gives you a drip that was keeping her, you know. So I wasn't able to talk to her, but I got this sense at one point of like, I was in the room and I could have, I had this sense that I was somewhere in between heaven and earth. There was just this moment where I felt like there's some sacred quality about this moment. And I looked up at the television and there was a church service playing. And this young man had been giving a testimony. And at the end of his testimony, he quoted from a book by John Stott, and they put the quote on the screen. And the quote was this one right here. "I could never myself believe in God if it were not for the cross. The only God I believe in is the one Nietzsche ridiculed as God on the cross. In this real world of pain, how could one worship a God who was immune to it?" And the whole quote is really something. I've never read the book, but that was the only part that they had on the screen.
Is that from his book on the cross of Christ?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I think so. I haven't read the book. I just remember that quote, and it was December 10th of 1989 when I saw this.
Yeah, that book came out then. I read it with, I was in an internship, and myself and my supervisor, we read it together. So it's a very good book.
Yeah, well, it made a tremendous impact on me because, I mean, I already deeply knew that Jesus Christ is real and that the story of the cross is real. I knew that at a deep level, but that was almost like an embrace when I saw that verse on the screen. And it reminded me of an embrace a couple of embraces that had happened the year before when I had been in Japan, when my husband left me, when I was really struggling there and just in so much pain. One day the phone rang, and transatlantic calls were very expensive in 1988. And the person who was calling me was a young woman that I had known from my home church who had very, very limited financial resources and very limited education. So I don't even know how she figured out how to make a transatlantic call. And she was a very simple person with very difficult life. But she had heard what had happened. And I get this phone call on a day when I'm just deeply suffering, and it's her. Her name is Kathy. And she said, "Karen, I just want you to know that it says here in God's word that all things work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose." That means, Karen, that means even this thing.
Wow.
And I mean, I was just undone, you know, that God cared enough about me that he would send me that message on that day in that way, was just beyond me. So I had many experiences like that, you know, where I would get these embraces. There was another time when I was struggling and I was worshiping. I remember I was standing in the shower and I was worshiping just out of the pain. And all of a sudden I just felt this waterfall of joy and love and immense pleasure in God's presence just wash over me and fill me. And I mean, I was just, it was impossible to explain and almost impossible to hold on. There wasn't enough of me to hold that feeling. It's like C.S. Lewis always says, you know, it's in the suffering that you really, really come face to face with the love of God.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you can know that God loves you, but you can't really know that God loves you until you're in the valley with him.
Right. There's different kinds of knowing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very, it's very true. It's hard stuff. It's hard stuff to talk about, but it's true. It's true.
Well, and I think the bigger thing I'm trying to say here is that it's this thread of suffering. Every person suffers. I mean, that's Jordan Peterson talks about that all the time, right?
Yeah.
That life is suffering. Well, he says life is suffering, but I think there's an error there somewhere, because that makes the identity of life to be suffering, right?
Right.
So something's wrong with that.
Right.
There is suffering in life, and every person goes through it.
Yep.
And there is also somehow a purpose in suffering, so that in a sense, the present rewrites the past, because
yes.
When you come through the valley, you come through the trail of tears, so to speak. You come through that was the wrong terminology to use, excuse me. when you come through some sort of struggle, some sort of set of sufferings that you've gone through, and you get to the other end and you begin to see, oh my goodness, I'm in this place of great beauty now, and I don't know that I could have appreciated this beauty before, but now I can see this beauty and I can see the purpose, and all of a sudden it goes back and it rewrites the whole story in the back.
Yep.
So I can, for a few years, I couldn't talk about this without sobbing, but now I can look back on it, and it's not only another lifetime, but it was another me, and that me doesn't exist anymore. And the me that exists now has more capacity for comfort and for beauty and for understanding and all of those things that was built out of that experience that wouldn't be possible today. Yeah. And I have a 25-year-old daughter who never would have been born if that hadn't happened. And I have a husband that I never would have met if that hadn't happened. And so you get to the rest of the story and it rewrites the past. And that is the piece that I think is missing. If you say life is suffering and you find meaning by picking up the heaviest load you can, well, no, I think you trust that the person who's leading you is trustworthy. And then you follow the leading. And if the leading leads you into the path of suffering, so be it. It may be really terrifying, but you can know that the one who's with you is holding your hand.
Yeah.
And you don't go looking for it, but if you fall into it, there is someone with you.
Yeah. Suffering and loss finds us all one way or another. Always. And you're right. Suffering is always individual. C.S. Lewis, have you read C.S. Lewis's The Problem of Pain?
Yeah.
And then you also, I mean, if you read The Problem of Pain, which is an early apologetic book, it's Lewis, the philosophical observer, and then you read, you know, A Grief Observed, where it's Lewis, the sufferer.
Yes, I think, I read that too. Yeah.
I think Tim Keller's best book is Walking with God Through Suffering. I've read a number of Keller's book, but I think that's his best book. He does. It's so, what it's, you have to be cautious talking about suffering because people suffer, and suffering is a funny thing because sometimes it makes people bitter and sometimes it makes people strong. And we don't, you know, for ourselves, in a sense, we have decisions we can make to decide whether the sufferings will make us,
because what suffering can give us is the capacity to be both more tender and stronger. And that's the opposite of bitter and hard. And it's because you meet people whose suffering has made them bitter and hard. And I agree with you that a vital difference is often one's capacity to have that suffering be transcended by, I mean, if you're, you know, when you say you're holding on to God through the suffering, in a sense, what you're doing is you're leveraging meaning to address suffering. That's essentially what you're doing, because, and I know Christians can do this cheaply, and Christians can do this in a pat, shallow way, but the Christians who are not cheap, pat, or shallow have almost always suffered and found that they were found that they learned how to suffer and were brought through suffering by trust in God. And, you know, so it's, you know, Peterson's talk about meaning and suffering. It's vitally important to understand those two together, because suffering without meaning is what makes us bitter and hard and crushes us. Yeah, suffering and love, it's tough, tough stuff. But we are out of time, and I don't want to make the next person suffer.
That was a very great segue.
Well, thank you, Karen. And yeah, thanks for sharing some of your story. It's a big deal when people come on this channel and share their story. It's no small thing to just tell your story and put it on YouTube, and any person can listen to it, and any person can comment. I don't close the comment sections. I haven't yet. Maybe I wouldn't someday for some reason. But and then, of course, people are going to have all kinds of opinions about you and your choices and your experience, and some of those people will entitle themselves to comment on it in unkind or generous ways. And so it's no small thing to share ourselves. And I think we do so in the hope that what we say will be helpful. And
yes,
that's a good thing. But yep. I've got the next guy is already in the room. It's a good thing I locked this room, or he'd be with us right now.
Say hi for me.
Okay, Karen. Take care.
Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.